Thank you all for being here. I want to acknowledge that we are on traditional Iroquois territory. I want to thank all the people who worked very hard to make this a beautiful evening, to fill this beautiful theater, the student unions who gave the tickets away, Ricochet, an exciting new media project, Ethan Cox in particular, who has been working very hard on this. And the Gasset Dawson, it's so wonderful to share the stage with you. I like sharing the radio waves with you as well. And it is such an honor to be here with Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois. Gabrielle, you helped wake the country out of its slumber a few years ago, as did the whole Quebec student movement, reminding us that winning is possible. Indeed, that's why we do the things we do. We actually want to win. And we remain so grateful for your many contributions. Thank you, Gabrielle. This is a very special day and night for me. This is the official launch day of this book that I've been working on for 5 years. And we had a little preview launch in Toronto last night. But this is launch day, and it's wonderful to be doing it in Montreal, which is the city where I was born, as Anne mentioned. Though my family left Montreal and moved to British Columbia, my parents, Bonnie and Michael Klein, are here tonight to celebrate with us. So I want to acknowledge them and welcome them. And many, many friends who feel like family are here in the first couple of rows. So thank you all for being here tonight. I also did want to acknowledge my wonderful publisher, who's just done such a beautiful job with this book, designing this cover that has already kind of gone viral around the world, and Shona Cook from Random House Canada, who's here and been helping me on the road. And I also do want to mention that my French language publisher, as you heard, Lux, is going to be publishing the book in March. Louis-Frédéric is here from Lux, my editor. Je promets que je vais pratiquer mon français avant de la lancement. I have time to brush up. I also want to thank Martin Lucas, my friend and collaborator, wonderful Montreal area journalist who helped with research on this project, the documentary film that goes with it, and has also been helping me fight some of the information wars. I'm having trouble seeing my text here, so if there's any way of adjusting the lighting, it's kind of funny. If not, you know, then we'll just deal with it. it's just a weird thing. It could go like this. So I start the book by confessing that I used to be a climate change denier. And when I say that, I don't mean a climate change denier like, you know, Donald Trump or the Tea Party and the people who you say, like, because winter exists, climate change must not be real. But, you know, that's hard denial, and I've hung around with those people, and I have a chapter of the book about them and how they think and why they deny climate change. But in many ways, I think those deniers get too much attention. And frankly, I think we should sort of ignore them. We're not going to win them over. They're denying climate change because it threatens their worldview. They understand that in order to respond to climate change, it does require challenging capitalism. And therefore, it must not be real because capitalism and belief in free markets is so central to their core that it's unthinkable to imagine that it could be true, that this economic system could be destabilizing life on Earth, so the scientists must be part of a huge conspiracy. So that's them, and we can understand them, but I'm more interested in how the rest of us deny climate change, and I include myself in this. I think we all deny climate change because it's unbearable. It's unbearable to hold the idea in our head continuously that we are part of a system, that our actions are part of a system that is waging war on life on Earth. And it's particularly hard to look because we are in a culture that is acting as if this is not happening. So on the one hand, we catch a glimpse of a news article telling us, you know, the Arctic ice is melting and ever more apocalyptic warnings from the IPCC, from climate scientists, you know, from every scientific organization in the world saying, you know, please listen. And then we turn on, you know, the television and we hear about the Energy East Pipeline or Line 9 or Northern Gateway or Kinder Morgan or a new fracking frontier or drilling in the Arctic. So it isn't like our politicians are doing nothing. They are hurtling down the wrong road. So how do we reconcile these completely contradictory thoughts, these completely contradictory ideas? We start telling ourselves stories like, well, you know, it must not be that big a problem after all, or the environmentalists are dealing with it, or we must have more time, or there's going to be some techno fix that's going to bail us out at the last minute. You know, humans are very clever, this is what we do. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. Or we just tell ourselves we're focused on more immediate concerns, right? You know, we can't focus on something so far off, even though we know that climate change isn't far off. We saw the water in the subways in New York. We saw the people on their rooftops in New Orleans holding signs that said, help, we've experienced it in our own lives with more and more weird, strange weather. Maybe we tell ourselves that, you know, all we can do is change ourselves. You know, we can meditate and we can, you know, change our lifestyle and sort of turn our personal life into a piece of low carbon performance art. But as far as engaging with the system that is taking us down that road, well, you know, that's a lot of kind of bad energy and there's no point in doing that anyway. And these are the stories we tell ourselves. And I don't want to belittle those important actions that we take as individuals. But I think if that's all we do, that is also a form of looking away, even though it may look like we're looking very hard. So the argument I'm making in the book is that we'll never be able to look all the time. It's just too hard. But we need to give it a good long look. We need to focus on those stories that we have been clicking past. Choosing not to read, looking away from and saying, I just can't handle this today. We need to look and we need to absorb what 97% of climate scientists are telling us. And we need to find ways to form community with one another to actually feel the grief and the loss that comes along with that, because it is an emotional process. You know, environmentalists, they have this model of change that is like a lot of environmentalists, okay, not all environmentalists, have been accused of generalizing, so I will say that some of the big green groups sort of have this theory of change that involves like, okay, I'm gonna scare the hell out of people and then they're gonna become activists, right? And that's not actually how we change. You know, you scare the hell out of people, tell them the world is ending, they actually want to curl up at a ball, especially if they're getting that news alone at home in a direct mail or on an email blast or on television. So we have to find ways to support each other in community. And being here in Montreal reminds me of growing up in the feminist movement with my mom and her friends at Studio D. You know, they would show films in our living room and cry. but you know, film was this, it was an emotional, I grew up with this idea of social change being an emotional process that we support each other through. You don't challenge people's worldview and say, see ya, hope it goes well, go become an activist. You have to stick around, you know, to pick up the pieces. So we need to acknowledge that sharing this news has emotional ramifications for people. But we need to look. And we need to look because I think that if we allow ourselves to feel the terror that comes with this news and the urgency of the timelines we are on, just how short the time is. You know, people have started calling this decade zero for climate action. We either act within the next 5 years because we're halfway through this decade. or we are locking in catastrophic climate change for generations to come. So if we absorb the urgency, it becomes clear, as Gabrielle alluded to, that only radical change has a chance of averting catastrophe in time, and that's because we've waited so long. You know, since governments started coming together to talk about climate change in the early 90s, emissions, global emissions, have gone up by 61%, right? So it's not like, you know, sometimes we talk about how we're not doing anything. It's much worse than that. If we were doing nothing, it would be static. But the issue is that our greenhouse gas emissions have been increasing year after year, and those emissions stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So there is what Michael Mann, the famed climate scientist at Penn State University, calls a procrastination penalty, which means that if we had started in 1990, as we were supposed to, then we could have reduced our emissions gradually. But because we didn't, we now have to reduce our emissions rather suddenly, by 10% a year, starting now. And the problem with that is that it is incompatible with the logic of mindless economic growth of the sort that Stephen Harper is always talking about and using as an excuse for why there can be no climate action, because he understands this. He understands that there is a fundamental conflict between that economic model and taking science seriously. Now, for someone like Stephen Harper, who is committed to defending that, that ideology, those set of interests that created that ideology, obviously this is climate science is pretty terrifying, but if you think there's something wrong with that economic system for a whole lot of other reasons, some of which we heard tonight, because they are waging war not only on the climate system, but also on our social programs, the education system, the healthcare system, our public infrastructure, our sense of community, our health, then the fact that this is also waging war on the planet's life support systems would seem to be an extra good reason to change it. I believe that climate change presents us with a once-in-a-century opportunity to transform the global economy for the better, to turn the world right side up. It demands that we invest massively in the public sphere, because of course we have to protect ourselves for the weather, the heavy weather we've already locked in, and we need huge public works projects to roll out the renewable energy economy that is within our grasp. The technology is there. It's, you know, we know that it's doable, but it takes huge public expenditure to do it. As does it take to build the public transit systems and the light rail systems that we need. So we need to invest in the public sphere. We need to invest in science education. We need to invest in science generally. It presents us with an opportunity to create huge numbers of jobs. If you take a dollar spent in the oil and gas industry and divert it into energy efficiency, renewable energy, public transit, it creates 7 to 8 times as many jobs. So it's not a choice between jobs and the environment. It's a choice between mindless growth and the environment, but there are more jobs if we take this route. It requires that we tackle some of the most persistent and institutionalized forms of injustice within our countries and between our countries, systems of racism and colonialism that have wounded our world for too long. It requires that we build a fairer world. And that is because some of the largest pools of carbon left are under the lands of some of the poorest people in the world. And unless there is justice, there will be climate change. The environmental crisis, if conceived sufficiently broadly, neither trumps nor distracts from our most pressing political and economic causes. On the contrary, it supercharges each of them with existential urgency, and it puts us on a firm and unyielding deadline. Now, as I said, I think our political elites understand this well, which is why they either deny climate change or propose false solutions, whether it's voluntary agreements between CEOs who get together at gatherings like the one that's going to be taking place in New York next week at the United Nations. You know, the UN has called the summit, but it's clear that the leaders aren't taking this seriously. But they're saying, well, don't worry about that because we have, you know, dozens of CEOs from companies like Bank of America and Suez, a major water privatizer, that are going to come together and solve this crisis for us. In other words, rather than getting the polluters to pay for this crisis, we are turning to the polluters to solve it for us. And I think that will go about as well as bringing the banks together to regulate themselves. So they propose these false solutions precisely because they are afraid of the real solutions. And some of those false solutions increasingly are techno fixes on a global scale, sometimes called geoengineering, the idea that rather than cutting our emissions, we will spray a sulfur into the stratosphere and dim the sun and cool the planet down. And what could possibly go wrong there? But the more we fail to get at the root causes of this crisis, which is the pollution, the more these false solutions will be trumpeted and be presented as reasonable and serious. So the pollution to the solution to pollution is now, it turns out, pollution. In the book, I make the argument that the reason we have failed to rise to the challenge presented to us by climate change is not any of the usual explanations that we so often hear, like that humans are greedy, that it's human nature not to want to tackle a far-off threat, even though this threat is anything but far-off, as I said, and even though there are many precedents in history of humans coming together in the face of threats that are not immediate. We're told that it's just simply too complicated for governments to come together and come up with a rule, for the entire world, even though we've done it before. There was just a report about the Montreal Protocol on ozone depletion, which actually has been an incredible success, and the ozone layer is healing because of decisions made in Montreal. In 1987, when governments came together and decided to phase out the substances that were causing the hole in the ozone layer, it is true that banning hairspray is easier than banning oil, right? But it's also true that as time went on, the timing for this crisis got worse. That was 1987. 1988 was the year that there was the first gathering of governments to tackle emission reductions. So I would say, what else was happening in 1988? Well, let's think about it. Well, the first free trade deal was being signed between Canada and the United States. The year after that, 1989, was the collapse of the Berlin Wall. Francis Fukuyama was declaring history over. So this issue landed on our laps, and this was the point after which there could be no plausible deniability. This was the moment where the scientific consensus really hit the mainstream. This was the moment when Time magazine had to choose a man of the year, and they chose Planet Earth. This was our window, and yet it happened at the most triumphant moment for neoliberal orthodoxy, when this ideology was being spread around the world, when regulation became a dirty word, when austerity policies were introduced in force around the world. So what I do in the book is show in concrete ways how doing the things we must do to respond to climate change clash directly with the pillars of neoliberalism, being privatization, deregulation, cuts to government spending, or austerity, and also free trade, the logic of free trade and the signing of ever more free trade deals, of which we've just apparently signed one with China. So I'll give a few examples of how this clash plays out. I live in Toronto. Ontario has had a pretty good green energy program, introduced, amazingly enough, by the Liberal government. It had very ambitious targets. It was introduced in the midst of the economic crisis in 2009 because the auto industry was collapsing. And part of what allowed this plan to be sold, of setting very ambitious targets for phasing out coal, was that it would be an answer to the jobs crisis. And so in addition to introducing a feed-in tariff and providing incentives for renewable energy and for people to be able to benefit from basically subsidized energy, anybody who became an energy provider had to commit to a certain amount of local production. 40 to 60% of the solar panels and the wind turbines had to be made in Ontario. So it was a combination of a climate policy and a job program. And it got buy-in from the trade unions, and it was a popular policy, and it was working. It created 31,000 manufacturing jobs. We started to see manufacturers move to Ontario because this market had been created. Well, a couple years later, Japan and then the European Union took Canada to the World Trade Organization and challenged this policy on the grounds that it violated Canada's obligations under the World Trade Organization not to discriminate against foreign companies. It was unfair to Japanese and European solar and wind turbine makers to have this local by local requirement. And they won. The WTO ruled that the Ontario plan was illegal. So trade trumped the climate, even though this was a very successful trade policy. And this has been happening again and again. The US took China to the WTO. They took India to the WTO. Both China and India are threatening retaliation. So at this moment, when we should be rolling out the most ambitious renewable energy programs possible, we are instead going to the World Trade Organization and trying to knock down each other's windmills, which is kind of crazy. The other way this is happening is that when you have a success like the shale gas moratorium here in Quebec, a hard-won political success, that also is vulnerable to challenges under free trade rules. And in fact, there's a U.S.-registered company, not actually an American company, that is challenging the shale gas moratorium, Quebec's shale gas moratorium, under NAFTA, and saying that this unfairly robs it of its right to drill under the St. Lawrence. TransCanada is making noises saying that if Obama does in the end nix the Keystone XL pipeline, that there could be a trade retaliation. Like, what right does the US have to say no to this pipeline? And this, of course, is the fear of the Canada-China free trade deal, would be that if we do manage to stop something like the Northern Gateway pipeline, and I believe we will stop the Northern Gateway pipeline, then China could potentially challenge that under that free trade deal. So that's a pretty straight up clash between neoliberalism and what we need to do to address the climate crisis. The other most obvious one I alluded to earlier, which is just the basic clash between the logic of austerity, the endless cuts to the public sphere, and what we need to do in response to this crisis. And this came to a head in the UK in an interesting way during a season of terrible flooding a year ago, where David Cameron, sort of Mr. Austerity himself, was caught kind of flat-footed because he had gutted the agency that was responsible for flood defense in the UK. They had nixed hundreds of flood defense programs. More than 1,000 people had been laid off. Another 1,000 were on the chopping block. And people started to make the connection. Wait a minute, large parts of Britain are underwater. We really need help. How smart is it at this point in history when the climate scientists are telling us we're going to see more and more events like this to be hacking away at the public services that we need most? And it was interesting because Cameron was so under siege in this moment that he very famously said that money was no object, that he would spend whatever was necessary. And because he saw that there was a real political cost in that moment. No, crisis does that, the question is whether that could be leveraged not just in an individual, in a moment of crisis, when there's a storm or when there's flooding, but whether the crisis of climate change more broadly could be used to challenge the austerity agenda. And I think it can, and I think it can also be used to challenge the free trade agenda. I think we should have been talking about that much more in the context of the China deal, and also in the context of the European free trade deal. It cannot be illegal to protect our planet, but that is precisely what these deals are locking in. So the other thing that happened in the UK in the midst of that flooding is, so there was this call, okay, Cameron has to spend whatever it takes to save these communities that are underwater, that have lost electricity, that have lost rail access. But the Daily Mail, which is a very right-wing tabloid in the UK, launched this petition, and the petition called on the British government to divert money that was slotted for foreign aid and use it to help flood victims at home. So it was this very xenophobic response, right? Why are we helping those poor people of color in other countries when our own are underwater, right? And it got hundreds of thousands of signatures. This is the ugly side of how we respond to climate change if it is locked within this mentality of false scarcity. And in fact, we're seeing this writ large, where if we are to unlock the climate deadlock, there have to be transfers of resources, technology, of wealth from the global north to the global south, because this is a crisis that was created in the global north. We have a 200-year head start on emissions. As I said, emissions build up, and yet the effects of climate change are overwhelmingly being felt in the poorest countries. If they are going to develop, if they are going to leapfrog over fossil fuels, there has to be that income redistribution. But of course, that's off the table. We're told that within the logic of endless economic crisis, we can't even talk about increasing foreign aid, let alone talking about climate justice and climate debt. So this is another way in which the logic has to be challenged. Then you have privatization, and this is, of course, one of the key pillars of the neoliberal era, that all of our public services are better handed over to the private sector. Now, one of the success stories in the context of climate change, one place that we can point to that is very rapidly switching its economy over to renewables, is Germany. It's been getting more and more attention. The German transition is really quite dramatic. In a little over a decade, Germany has transitioned 25% of its electricity to renewable energy, much of it wind and solar, much of it decentralized wind and solar. So it's not, you know, just huge renewable energy operators with massive wind farms and solar arrays. It's overwhelmingly small scale. You've got 900 new energy cooperatives that are providing energy to their communities. You have small-scale utilities at the community level, and this is working. And so this really challenges the idea that only, that we need like big centralized solutions like nuclear power, GMO industrial agriculture, and this is, this is part of the false solutions to climate change that we hear more and more. In fact, what we see in Germany is that the country with the best track record, the fastest transition, is happening through a decentralized revolution. It's a combination of bold national policy. They've got a fantastic feed-in tariff policy that is encouraging this decentralized response. So it's a multiplicity within the context of a bold national plan. But a piece of this that gets almost no attention when Germany's transition is covered is that this part of the reason why this is happening is that in hundreds of German cities and towns, people have voted to take control over their electricity grids back from the private companies that privatized them in the 1990s. And this is, the city of Hamburg, for instance, voted just a few months ago to take back their electricity grids, specifically because they were not happy that the private energy provider would not be part of this energy transition, that they weren't switching fast enough to renewable energy. In Berlin, 83% of voters in a referendum voted to take back their energy grid from the private operator, specifically so that they could get to 100% renewable energy. And you know, we'll see what happens in Berlin, because not enough people turned out for the vote to make it binding, but the public opinion is very, very clear on this. And what people are finding in Germany, and this has also happened in North America, the city of Boulder in Boulder, Colorado, which is a very green city, decided that it didn't make any sense for them to be always held up as one of the greenest cities in the U.S. You know, everybody wears fleece and bikes everywhere, but they're powered by coal, right? So they saw, we don't want this. This doesn't fit our values. So they went to the private energy provider, the private utility that had taken over the grid, and they said, we want renewable energy. And the private energy provider basically wasn't interested. There wasn't enough money in it. There wasn't as much money in it. So there's been a series of referendums in Boulder that have won, despite being outspent in the first referendum at 10-1, to take back control over their energy grid. And what's interesting is that these are not ideological. This is not an ideological movement. The people in Boulder didn't start off being anti-privatization. They started off being just wanting clean energy. But what they found was that that desire put them into conflict with the for-profit interests of the company that was running their energy. So then they became anti-privatization activists. So coming back to Germany, one of the things, so I've held this up as a success, and I think it is a success because it shows that the transition can happen so quickly. It's a highly industrialized country. It's a country that, I think Canadians can relate to. If Germany can do this, there's no reason why we can't do it. It's not terribly sunny over there either. And yet, for the last couple of years, Germany's emissions have been going up. So this doesn't make any sense. How could Germany's emissions be going up while they're switching to renewable energy? And the reason for that is that the Merkel government, though it's been willing to sort of bend the rules of neoliberalism enough to put these incentives in place, has been unwilling to sort of break rule number one, which is say no to big, powerful corporations. So it has not stood up to the coal lobby, which is a very powerful lobby in Germany, much as the oil and gas industry is here. So the coal industry has continued to dig up not just coal, but lignite coal, which is the dirtiest form of coal, much higher carbon emissions than regular coal, which is already very high. And they're now exporting the electricity because the market is going down in Germany. So once again, this brings up the issue of trade and whether they even have the power to say no. So what's interesting in Germany is that as the Merkel government fails to say no to the fossil fuel companies, the same grassroots movements that had demanded that energy transition in the first place are now taking direct action to block coal exports, to block coal mining, and stepping in where the government has failed. And this is happening around the world, where our governments have failed to live up to their core responsibilities. Regular people are stepping into the breach, and they are trying to block the pipelines, trying to block the export terminals, blocking the fracking, blocking the pipelines. And the moratorium against fracking in Quebec has been very important as an example around the world. Talking to French activists for the research of this book, they talked about how important it was when they were facing fracking and didn't even know what it was to link up with activists here in Quebec to learn about the successes here, and France became the first country to block fracking overall. And I think because this is often dismissed as this doesn't mean much, it's just sort of like pockets here or there. It's worth taking a look at just the scale of these victories and how much carbon has been kept out of the atmosphere because of them. There have been fracking bans and moratoriums, one in France, Bulgaria, the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, Vermont, Newfoundland, New York State. At the same time, 170 U.S. coal plants have been closed down. 180 proposed new coal plants have been blocked. coal export terminals up and down the Pacific Northwest of the United States, because of course, as the coal market collapses in the US, the coal industry wants to do the same thing in the US that they are doing in Germany, which is export the stuff, in this case to China. But that plan isn't going very well either, because communities are acting as choke points. They are resisting the construction of these export terminals. They are resisting the construction of new railways to get the coal out of the mines. And it's becoming a pretty dodgy investment. And of course, we have the fact that the Keystone XL pipeline was slotted to be rubber stamped about 3 years ago, and it has been in a state of limbo all of that time. And the incredible resistance against the Northern Gateway Pipeline, led by First Nations in British Columbia, and the growing resistance against Energy East. And I think that there's going to be a lot of action here in Quebec, and I hope you guys all will get involved, those of you who aren't already involved, and Line 9. Because as they face resistance going south and going west, they're coming east, and we need to be ready for them. We need to have them surrounded. You know, the thing about Alberta is it's landlocked. They have to get that oil somehow to the sea. The latest idea is to take it through the melting Arctic. You know, as my friend Mike Kudima wrote, worst idea ever, right? But it does show the suicidal logic at play. Then you have the incredible growth of the divestment movement, the fossil fuel divestment movement. I know there are a lot of people here. Are there some people here from the Concordia and McGill divestment movements? Anybody here? You know, I think, I personally, I've never seen a student movement spread so quickly. There were a few campuses that had campaigns to divest from coal in the States, and then the National Fossil Fuel Divestment Movement was launched, and basically 6 months later, you had hundreds of campuses on board. You had about around a dozen cities that were announcing that they were going to divest their holdings. Now, many religious organizations, churches, synagogues, have announced that they are also going to bring their investments in line with their values. You know, this is not going to bankrupt Exxon. And I think it's part of a really important delegitimization process. It basically says to the fossil fuel companies, these are odious profits. And it's not just saying it to the fossil fuel companies, it's saying it to our politicians, it's saying it to our media outlets. And eventually, I think the goal is for these companies to be pariahs like the tobacco companies were made into pariahs. And they weren't able to advertise, you know, on television. They used to be able to advertise on television. You know, it became politically problematic for politicians to take their money. But the piece of it that I'm most excited about is not just the divestment, it's the investment, it's the reinvestment, it's what could be done with this money once it's taken away from the Exxons and the Shells. And the exciting prospect of it funding the just transition that our governments refuse to fund. There are so many fantastic projects out there that are languishing for lack of funding. And I think this is particularly important when it comes to First Nations, where I think there's a tendency to see, you know, solidarity as just supporting a fight against a pipeline or helping donate to a legal battle against an extractive project. That's important, but even more important is helping to ensure that there are other economic opportunities beyond extraction in the communities that are really in the bullseye. And I think that there should be a principle at work, which is that the communities that are already on the front lines of the extractive economy, that are already dealing with the health impacts of this toxic system, should be first in line to receive the benefits of this new economy and really control those benefits as well. And that, to me, is the real hope of divestment. It's the investment piece. And you know, there's a often these this movement is really misunderstood, and we're only looking at a piece of it. You know, the people fighting the pipelines or the coal terminal are described as NIMBYists, not in my backyard, which is like a sort of a political slur. And there's, once again, a slogan from the French anti-fracking movement. Their slogan is, ni ici, ni ailleurs, not here or not anywhere, right? And what it's really about is drawing a line. It's about a principle, which is basically, when you're in a hole, stop digging, that there can be no new carbon frontiers. That's the last thing we should be doing, is opening up new frontiers. There can be no more sacrifice zones, is another way of thinking about this. We have built an energy system based on the idea of disposable people and disposable places. That has been built into the fossil fuel economy since the very beginning. We can have an economy that does not require sacrificial places or sacrificial people. And I think that has to be the guiding principle of everything we do moving forward. All right. Now, it happened to Gabrielle, so it's happening to me. I'm getting all confused with my paper. That made me feel better, by the way, that that even happens to him. So this isn't just about stopping a pipeline. It's not even just about stopping the tar sands. It's about the logic fueling the whole thing, the logic that sacrifices life on the altar of money. We are living in a moment where it isn't only a river, a mountain, a watershed, a culture, a species that is being sacrificed. It's the stability of Earth's systems that support life. Friends, we are up against a psychotic logic that has profoundly confused destruction with creation. And that is the logic that we fundamentally have to change, not just by saying no to Harper's worst ideas, but by proposing and demonstrating real alternatives, relationships to the land based not on ever larger sacrifice zones, but on protecting and regenerating life in everything that we do. The stakes are simply too high and time too short to settle for anything else. A year ago, I was in Greece working on this documentary film, and in Greece, you really see, and this is why we were there, what happens when you have an economic system that does not factor in the health of the planet at its center. Because all over Southern Europe, as it's been ravaged by austerity politics in the midst of the economic crisis, all of these countries that had pretty good environmental policies have slashed them, cut all those programs. And in Greece, not only have they slashed all their renewable energy programs, but there's now this huge push to open up their beautiful seas to oil and gas drilling. And it's extraordinary. You know, here is a country whose main industries are tourism and fishing, and they're told that their only way out of crisis is to risk massive disaster of the kind that we saw in the Gulf of Mexico. And the crazy thing is that all the political parties are signed on to this, even the left-wing Syriza, which many of us had a lot of hope for. They say we should drill for oil, but we should spend the money on pensions, not on paying off the debts. We can do better than that. And I had the opportunity to meet with Alexis Tsipras, who's the young leader of Syriza, and which is now the opposition party in Greece. And I was having dinner the night before with a group of friends, and I was asking them, okay, what should I ask him? If you were going to be sitting across the table from Alexis Tsipras, what would you ask him? And they threw around a bunch of questions, and then one guy said, ask him, history knocked, did you answer? And I thought, that's a really good question for all of us. Thank you.